Well, good afternoon, everybody. Because I'm sure this session is going to generate all sorts of stimulating questions and discussion and so forth, I want to get underway on time. So, welcome. I don't think, actually, our two speakers here need a whole lot of introduction. I think if you don't know the immediate past president, Barry Rafe, and the chief executive of the Institute, Melinda Howes, then you're probably at the wrong conference. And this might be your cue. Anyway, welcome, thank you, and I'll hand over to Barry to take us from there, and we'll try and make sure that there's enough time for questions and discussions afterwards.
Okay, thank you, John. And I should say at the start, the outset, these are our views, they're not the Institute's views. It might be confusing when you read the paper, I know. The objective today is... This paper emerged from discussion from some thinking that Melinda and I were doing independently of each other, and it was around trying to develop the public policy for the Actuaries Institute. And what we found was that a lot of it's to do with building scenarios of what the future is going to look like. And we thought the actuaries have some contribution to understanding those issues, but there's a lot more powerful forces than just longevity. There's issues around the social policy, there's issues around individual behaviour. So the objective of this paper is to talk about absolutely everything and living to 120. But given the time constraints, we'll probably limit ourselves and we'll focus in the end on issues to do with the actuarial profession, certainly in question time. So the objective now will be to... Melinda will talk about longevity issues. I'll then talk about some behavioural social issues. Melinda will talk about product development. And we'll basically finish off borrowing the brains, as Todd Sampson said this morning, of four different organisations to see what they would have done with financial services. So I'll hand over to Melinda to talk about longevity. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. Well, let's start off with what we know. Back in 2002, the United Nations released a report and they stated that population ageing is unprecedented. It's a pervasive global phenomenon. It's affecting all of us. It's enduring. We're never going to return to the young populations that our ancestors knew. And it has profound implications for every aspect of human life. We're going to talk about some of the implications for financial services. Now, we also know that life expectancy is improving. And this is an ABS chart that you've probably all seen. This has been happening for some time, but as you can see, it's accelerated more recently. Lastly, we know that life expectancy is different for different socioeconomic groups. And this graph shows professionals on the top with their life expectancy and manual workers on the bottom and then the range in between. So we know a lot, but what don't we know? Actuaries have been modelling mortality for more than 100 years. So we're very good at predicting gradual increases in life expectancy. But Houston, we have a problem. In their paper done for the Henry Tax Review, actuaries Mike Sherris and John Evans of the Uni of New South Wales said that longevity risk is made up of three things. The known knowns, and that's the general improvement trend from socioeconomic improvements, as we see here. The known unknowns, and that's some variation around that longer-term mean. And then there's the unknown unknowns, sudden changes from wars, pandemics, and disease management. They go on to say that that unknown unknown risk is impossible to manage as it's not predictable and therefore appropriate allowances for these possible changes in pricing isn't feasible. Now the next chart shows the success rate that UK actuaries have had with predicting mortality improvements. And as you can see from this chart, the dark line is actual longevity, so actual life expectancy. And then all those lines coming off the side of it are where we thought it was going in each of those years. And as you can see, we've consistently underestimated how quickly mortality or longevity is improving. The problem, of course, is discontinuities. Normal modelling techniques can't handle big jumps. They can't handle things like major medical breakthroughs, a cure for cancer, viruses. Although I know Uni of New South Wales are doing some work on this right now. But if you just look at the list of the medical advances that happened over the last decade in the noughties, those things all have potential to have significant impact on life expectancy and on our quality of life. And we expect that in this decade we'll have an even faster rate of advance. So turning to the future, while we're discovering cures to many medical disorders, the maximum age people are living to hasn't actually changed for hundreds of years. It's been pretty static at around 120. So the human body has a natural expiry date.
Well, does it? So the issue with longevity is it's driven by technology, and you'll find that technology is moving substantially. So most of the list of things that Melinda had up there were technology driven. So who can remember Moore's Law? Gordon Moore, in 1965, observed that, and he was a co-founder of Intel, he observed that the number of transistors you can put on a chip doubled every 2 years, and that's powerful compound interest. And if you actually look at that now, and you did a graph, you would find that it's exactly tracked. And in fact, the this is over 40 years, 40 years at double every year, doubling every 2 years, is a million times. So we can now get a million times more transistors on a chip than we could do when Neil Armstrong first stepped on the moon and they had the computer that landed them there. So the issue is that all of this is happening so rapidly, and technology transformation is happening so rapidly. Now, mathematically, you can't get smaller than a certain size of transistor. And so they reckon that the thing is going to stop in 6 or 7 years. But I was reading in the paper the other day, you can now measure the rotation of electrons around an atom, and they reckon that's the new way of building computers is down to the size of the atom, which means you can see this doubling every 2 years happening continuously. And if you look at the next 2 years, we're going to get the same advancements we've had since the 70s again in the next 2 years.
Pretty amazing stuff. So given that we've had that massive rate of advancement in technology, what's the next growth area? What's the next thing that's going to really kick the human race along? It's predicted that we're at the start of a similar massive growth curve for life sciences, and that it will be biomedical technology aided by IT that drives that next series of advancements. Some futurists think that the first person to live till 200 years old has already been born. Now, we don't have any hard science to prove that, but there are scenarios where that's feasible. Let's take a couple of examples of some of this amazing new biomedical technology. And we mentioned a range of other things in the papers, like the fact that they can grow pretty much any organ in your body now from scraping a few skin cells off your arm. But this stuff really gets you thinking. First of all, we'll look at Oscar Pistorius, otherwise known as Blade Runner or the fastest man on no legs. He's a South African Paralympian. He was born without the tibia bones in his legs, and he uses prosthetic springs to walk and run. In 2008, scientists realised that he enjoyed considerable advantages over able-bodied athletes, and he was banned from competing with them. That decision was reversed, and he tried out for the 2008 Olympics, but unfortunately missed the cut by 1 second. By 2011, his times had improved, and he qualified for last year's World Championships and this year's Olympics. In the World Championships, he won a silver medal in the 4x400 metres relay. He's the first amputee to win an able-bodied world track medal. How long will it be till Oscar and others like him are unbeatable by able-bodied athletes? Secondly, cochlear implants. Now, people who are born deaf who have hearing aids can, at the moment, hear around 70% of what's said in a crowded restaurant. And maybe next year that'll be 80%, and the year after 90%. And then we'll get to a point where they can hear better than someone with normal hearing. And you can see a time in maybe a decade or 15 years' time when you won't be able to get a job in a symphony orchestra unless you have a cochlear implant. Science fiction's become fact. We're staring down the barrel of long longevity, where we can cure major diseases, replace organs, perhaps even reverse the ageing process. And there's a futurist called Ray Kurzweil who has some pretty out there views, but he thinks that if he can live long enough for this bio and nanotechnology to kick in, so probably the next 40 years, he'll live forever.
So a lot of our clients are actually writing annuity type products, and there's a sort of a flippant question really, when is a person dead? So how much of a person's body do you have to replace before they can be officially classified as dead? Even more outrageous, within less than 20 years, you're about to take my brain and put it in a vat. I'll be downloading stuff. People might think that's a good idea. I can be downloading information from the NBN and having a fantastic time in there. Nobody would know it. and I'd be able to communicate with the whole world, but would I be entitled to an age pension? So these are pretty important social questions.
So let's look at some of the impacts right now. In Western societies, baby boomers are retiring, and the first lot of them retired last year. So what impact will that have on financial services businesses? Well, this is something we're all aware of. Over the next 5 years, $329 billion, or about a third of Superfund assets, will move over that tipping point into the retirement phase. And that's about 10% of Superfund members. So their accounts will go from net inflow to net outflow. In the next 15 years, the amount in drawdown will be a quarter of current members and about 63% of current assets in super. So when this happens, pretty much over the next 15 years, every super fund in Australia will go from net inflow to net outflow. So trustees will need to think quite differently about their investments. They'll need to move from a situation where the cash is coming in to a large and ongoing redemption program. And if assets are going to take a while to change and move, if they're illiquid, they need to start thinking about those things straight away. What about individual retirees? Well, current retirees will be retired around 30 years, and in that time, they'll probably experience 3 to 5 market crashes. So in future, when we're retired for maybe 50 years, assuming we keep retiring in our 60s, they're going to be even more susceptible, those retirees, to market reversals. They'll see more and more of them. So protection from market downturns will become even more important than now. What do retirees want, or what will they want in the future? I think that's largely unchanged. The three key things they want are an income to survive, flexibility of income and of access to their capital, and lastly, protection. And the two biggest risks they face are, first of all, market risk, as I mentioned, and secondly, longevity risk.
So then we have all the social issues. Now, I'm not a sociologist, but I do watch TV. And I notice on TV people marching on the streets in Greece because their retirement age for some people is being lifted from 50 to 52. Now, this is for people like hairdressers and other people in what they classify as high-risk occupations. And the reason hairdressers are classified as high-risk occupations is because 30 years ago, it used to be very dangerous chemicals. And so there are 500 careers in Greece. I'm not having a go at the Greeks, but there are 500 jobs that were classified as high-risk with a 50-year-old retirement age. And what's happening is that people now have, in Australia and everywhere, have an entitlement culture. People believe that if they work to 65 and they pay their taxes and do all the right things, then they're entitled to an age pension. The issue is that people don't realise that it isn't the generation funding itself. What it is we've got cascading generations paying for older generations. And as the entitlement culture and as we live longer, we've currently got about two generations paying the retirement benefits of one generation. And within our lifetime, there'll be two generations paying for the retirement benefits of two generations, and in some of our lifetime, two paying for three. And so there's a real intergenerational equity issue, and it just seems like it's got to break somewhere. And we have seen it break. We've seen Europe and massive austerity measures coming through. So when I was a baby actuary, we used to have these things called defined benefit pension plans. And we used to work on the basis that the government had a guarantee around certain things, and that was a locked-in guarantee. There are people now in Europe who have got lower pensions than they used to have because the government just can't afford it. So the government has defaulted on pension payments, and there are certainly some of the world's largest employers, General Motors and some of the big US companies, who've defaulted on their obligations and paying pension benefits and health benefits. So you can see there's a massive austerity view coming through. And as we go forward, you've got to wonder how the government's going to keep cutting back. Obviously, we're going to get more means testing. But is the government going to form a relationship, a partnership with financial services businesses to make sure that people behave properly? For example, would we be punished if we didn't invest in default products that the government thought we should invest in? So if you don't invest in default products, then you might not get a certain tax break. Is there going to be a commitment towards forcing people into age pensions or into sort of drawdown phase when they get a certain age, like 60, 65 or 70 or 75, where you've got to use your own money first in your super fund before you're allowed to access the age pension? And let's look at the regulator. I was in New Zealand 3 or 4 months ago, and there's an appointed actuary regime in New Zealand now, and the government requires a 1 in 1,000 capital requirement, 1 in 1,000 probability of ruin, 1 in 1,000 year probability of ruin from earthquake. So how much capital do you need to protect against that? And we've got discussions over here with APRA on LAGIC, greater capital requirements required, which you would expect for annuity products and long-term products. So the government says that if there's going to be guarantees, there's going to be more capital to back those guarantees, and people are going to pay for that backing with their own products. And if you look at the individual, there's much more of a distrust now of promises. There's a distrust of promises from financial services institutions, and there's a distrust of promises from governments and basically anywhere that has a long-term promise. People have now real doubts about that. And it's going to drive the view that products will then have to require quick escape routes before they can be sold. Individuals significantly underestimate their longevity. So people look at the life tables and they say, OK, well, my life expectancy is 85 based on the current life tables. Well, that's for people who were born 85 years ago. You know, the average person now, if you're healthy at 65, there's probably a more than 50% chance you could live past 100. So as you see, it's for existing people now where the longevity issue is actually going to start to kick in. People have a too high discount rate on their view of the future. So they're much more willing to spend now than save for the long term. People overestimate their chance of winning. So if people buy lotto tickets, for example, how many people here buy lotto tickets? Oh, there's a few, that's good. So that's only a small amount of money. People with Storm Financial and these sorts of organisations where the return looks too good to be true, people are optimistic about investing in these things because they overestimate the chances of winning. And one of the biggest myths, of course, is called financial education. How about we financially educate people so they can make their own decisions on these things? Well, you're not going to do that. People will not be financially educated. We can build financial awareness, but people just won't have enough nous, I mean, to be able to make their own decisions about financials, about the financial services industry, and about how much they should save. And probably most importantly about individuals is that we're social animals. We like networking sessions. We all want to be part of a tribe. And a lot of the decisions we make are based on what our peers do. And that's where most of these sort of high technology companies have come in, is they're building tribes of people, networks of people to sort of drag them along into making purchasing decisions.
So some of the things Barry was talking about have profound implications for product design and delivery. Who'll be best able to innovate financial services products in the future? Will it be FS businesses or non-FS businesses, such as the technology companies? They may be better at innovating and getting things to market. Will it be big or small companies? Big companies have scale and data. Small companies may be able to pilot new ideas more effectively. What's clear is that those organisations that have a strong and long-term relationship with their customers will be in a strong position. So super funds are actually in quite a good position because they have the entire working lifetime to build up a relationship with the customer, and they may not be as they may not need to maintain such a high profit margin going forward. Now, it's interesting that reinsurers are currently developing products to hedge against longevity, and they can offset those risks against their mortality books for things like pandemic risk or a natural hedge. But as Barry was mentioned, then technology companies are going to get in on the act here. We think that they'll provide the gateways through to product providers. So let's say that here I am, I'm planning my upcoming girls' trip to Bali on the iPad.
Linda, this is your robo-planner speaking. So there'll be a robo-planner. I notice you're booking a trip to Bali. That's great. And I notice you've also got a skiing trip next year. Do you realise that those two combined will mean that you've got to work an extra year if you want to achieve the plans that you've logged into the system on retirement age? And secondly, while I've got your attention...
Was it the shopping spree?
The shopping spree. And also you've got emails going backwards and forwards between you and your husband talking about investing in a couple more crates of wine, cases of wine. Now, that's not a good term. Investment is not the right term for that investment. And I noticed from your stock control app that a bottle of wine in your house lasts no more than 3 weeks on average.
Okay, so we'll see smart apps and maybe some dumb apps like that one emerge. So the technology brands we trust will actually be in the box seat to deliver financial services. And there'll likely be a trend towards more white labelling of products. So Google or Apple will come in, they'll give you your financial information, and the product provider becomes disintermediated. They become a wholesaler, squeezing down the profit margins.
So in looking at now, summarising where we've got to, we've got financial services businesses. What value is the brand in the financial service business? We saw NAB this morning and Eubank. So Eubank's the new brand, NAB's is the old brand. Maybe it's best if these old brands just basically cash cow their business, run it into the ground, and you have new brands starting up separately. Maybe Apple and Google will be the new brands. Is it better to be big or better to be small? How will superannuation funds fare? I mean, superannuation funds have the membership pre-retirement. It seems logical that they should be able to extend their product offering post-retirement. And will the government and the financial services industry form a partnership? And you can imagine there's a lot of attractions, as they do in disability, where there is a partnership between government and private sector. They could easily become that in the post-retirement space as well. And will the government tighten up, which they almost certainly will, on compulsory annuitisation or compulsory drawdowns of capital? So what we're going to do at the end is we've got picked four organisations. We're going to use the heads of different organisations to try and work out what they would do with the financial services industry. So firstly, the late Steve Jobs. So here's Apple. So what he's done is he's brought himself in the middle of the relationship between me and any number of records, any number of apps in the world. So this is my portal to the window. And Apple doesn't write any of the music that's on my iTunes, and it writes very few of the apps that are sitting on my computer. What everybody else writes those. And what Apple has done is they've got a sort of a luxury brand, and they've made it available to everybody, and they still get luxury profits out of it. And what would happen if Apple got hold of financial services is that everybody would have their own standalone fund. And I'd be able to log on and pick my fund managers based on fund managers that are available out there. And to help me do that, I'll have applications, I'll have a whole group of people who will be assessing these. There'll be social networks where there's downloads on assessment of different fund managers. There'll be market research groups. There'll be consumer groups who give me apps that can help me assess all these things. And there'll be projection software. All of that through here. So what he would do is disintermediate the whole business so that he owns a relationship and everybody else is just wholesaled out the back without him making anything himself. Second example is Pixar. Now, Pixar, quite a different organisation to what Steve Jobs would do. What Pixar do is they make films like Toy Story. And they're a very different model to a Hollywood model. What happens in Hollywood is that somebody gets the idea for a film and they bring all these different groups together to make the film, then all those different groups break apart and go their own way. What Pixar does is it recruits the smartest people, the most innovative people, and it sends them to their own Pixar university. And if they lose the edge, they sack them. And what Pixar does is it makes a very small group and very high specialised films. And in the financial services market, what they would do is they'd say, we'll get the best people in here and we'll make a very small group of products, maybe two or three products which are highly specialised, which you can choose from, but you would just choose one of their single brands. And then you would buy into the system and it would be that system that would drive you throughout your retirement age, automatically putting you into upgrading products, automatically making sure that everything was right for you.
Okay, how about Richard Branson if we had the Virgin makeover? They're all about sex appeal, cheekiness, great customer service and fun. And they're about building a lifetime relationship with their customers. So what they do is they start businesses in small clusters. They have no more than 60 people in each location, so everyone knows each other's name. So it's a big business running like an entrepreneurial family business. It has that startup feel. So a Virgin makeover of financial services, they'd be the hub. They'd outsource all the key capabilities. They'd buy in the trendiest, latest products on the market and deliver it to their customers in stylish packages. It'd be designed for the young market. They'd have advice light, low-cost trim-back service. And lastly, we have another deceased person, Kerry Packer. His business philosophy was to dominate. He's a consummate political operator. He owned media so he could influence the message. So under a Packer-esque makeover, we'd use the money in super funds to invest in media, buy TV and magazine assets. We'd also, of course, buy casinos. We'd be spending a lot of time and money wooing and influencing key politicians to implement favourable public policy for the financial services industry. Sport provides a strong emotional attachment, and so we'd have lots of promotion of sport and we'd build communities of our clients around their sporting interests. We'd buy and aggregate super funds to make a mega fund, perhaps even absorbing some of the not-for-profit funds on a, into our with-profits model on the promise of a better deal for their members. We'd either wipe mutuals out or consolidate them. And then following to the logical conclusion, we'd sell a lot for a huge profit and walk away.
So we haven't mentioned the term actuary yet. And just sort of in summary, where we've got to is, I mean, come on, guys, actuaries are the only people that understand capital and profit in the financial services industry. And what we're talking about here isn't so futuristic to the extent that it doesn't involve any of us. It does. We're actually the bubble that's creating the problem. Not actuaries, I mean us as people. So the issue for the actuarial profession is we can see this coming, right? Longevity is our sweet spot, but we can factor in all those other things as well in how we design products. And we're not saying that the actuaries should be entrepreneurs. What we're saying is that we need to position ourselves so that if you want to be a winning company, then you've got to have actuaries in your team. So the thing that will differentiate winning companies from losing companies is the extent to which they use actuaries. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Melinda and Barry. And I'd like to open it up to the floor for comments, questions and so on. So there is a microphone, which Julia will bring around. If you... Thanks, Wade.
Jeff Peck from Russell Investments. Barry, I really like the idea of the robo-planner. I think that would work really well at home. but if actuaries are going to sort of be incorporated within that type of technology, can you actually see a time where we could actually have that type of help within the household to deal with financial services, to deal with those bigger questions about how I get to my end goals? Is it real?
Oh, well, I think, I mean, in fact, interesting, seeing the Eubank... Oh, I should be okay with this. Seeing the Eubank presentation this morning means that you can actually work out which group you're in. So if you've got enough... If this technology will be able to track everything you do when you use your bank statements, where your money's invested. So theoretically, you can actually... If you've got enough smarts in it, you can bring it together. And on average, it will be right. But obviously there's averages, and obviously there'll be some more sophisticated modules than other modules. But I mean, I've got this theory. If I went to five financial planners and laid out everything that I need, you know, all my information, I should theoretically get back five plans exactly the same. So does that mean that financial... Because otherwise, why would they be different? If they're all equally qualified and I've got the same information... So that may mean that financial advice is generic. And if it's generic, then you can pump it into a spreadsheet and write a program about it, and it can be very sophisticated, but I think it will go 90% of the way to being able to do it, I would have thought.
And I think we're already at the start of that curve. We've already got mass advice models. We've already got people like QSuper building more individualised investment defaults into the super fund. So I think we're at the start of that now.
Thank you.
Ken Lockery. I guess I was interested that at the start we had a very forward-looking, you know, might live to 200, might live forever type view, and then we seem to fall back into financial services, and this is what we look like today, and superannuation funds. And I mean, first of all, if we have that, nobody will need a superannuation fund because the poor bastards will have to work forever because they won't know how long they'll live. So I'm not sure I want to be one of those people anyway. But I guess I just challenge the view that that we seem to have evolved everything outside us and then not looked enough at how things potentially change in that context, how living that much longer affects work and everything else, and the resources of the planet, to come back to the early part of the discussion today.
Yeah, you're right, Ken. We didn't cover absolutely everything we like.
If you can grow any organ from some skin scrapings, being a big Star Trek fan, nice. Why can't I have my replicator and then I don't need to work at all or have money or anything else?
That's right. I mean, there's clearly sustainability questions around all of this, and we didn't... I mean, and there's more in the paper. I guess the way we looked at it was there are certain forces at work, and we focus those forces on just looking at the implications on financial services, but they've got implications across the whole broad gamut of issues, that, you know, and some that we hadn't even thought about.
Yeah, so I guess what we're saying is these are the types of black swan scenarios that risk managers, enterprise risk managers in financial services organisations should be looking at these. And it's not just financial implications, as you said, it's social, it's environmental, it's all of that. You know, how's that going to affect your general insurance portfolio? You know, there's all of those issues.
And health being one of the things we didn't talk about as well.
Hello, Darren Wickham from Mercer. Thank you very much for a very, very interesting thought experiment. I look forward to being a brain in a vat next to you, Barry, plugged into the matrix. A comment and a question. I think there are implications for everything extending out to 120. Implications for society. If we had a cure for dementia or effective treatment for Alzheimer's, then we'd take 50% of people out of nursing homes. And that's quite a staggering societal shift. I'm interested in your views. If we live to 120, or maybe if we live to 200, when should you be eligible for the age pension? And I'd sort of take that the next step, is that I think 65 or 67 is actually a very arbitrary age, and that disability is actually a better trigger for receiving benefits, superannuation and Social Security.
Yeah, it's hard to see that we'd be wanting to retire at 65 if we're still active, healthy, and we've got another, you know, I can't do that in my head. What's that, 45, 50 more or more years to go? Yeah, so 60.
And Darren, we might actually be a brain in the vat at the moment, so... but I think you're right. We should abolish retirement age. I can remember a famous actor wrote a paper about that a couple of years ago. there's one European country, isn't there, that have linked it to life expectancy? So it's, who was that, Norway or somebody who've actually linked the retirement age to life expectancy? And if you phase it in long enough, then maybe it's less of a problem. But I think there's more of a psychology that, and that's what I talked about with the entitlement culture, really. And that sounds a bit mean, but I think there's an education process that needs to happen that says that if we want to leave a better world for our great-grandchildren, which seems to be an instinctive thing, that we want to leave a better world for our kids, if we want to leave a better world for them, then we need to be realistic about the fact that we can't expect us to be a burden on them forever. And part of our public policy process is looking at trying to promote the idea that generations should fund themselves. So that's ultimately the scenario, is we can't do it for a few generations, but generations should ultimately think about how they fund themselves going forward rather than relying on previous generations.
Thank you. Tony?
Tony Lally, Sun Super. This whole question of longevity is fascinating, and one of the things I'm curious in your views on this is we've seen already that the age pension was 65 and people... life expectation was 57, and it's never changed. And as you say, in Greece, it was 50. When we live to 200, I mean, I don't know how this is going to happen, whether it's going to be a very gradual one or it's going to happen in 5 years or 10 years, and all of a sudden we find a cure for cancer and dementia and everything you can imagine. But the real question I'm asking, and it's more of, an opinion I'm looking for, if people do extend the life to 120, 150 or 200, is it a case you're going to be an old person for a long time? Are your middle year stretching out? Because that's the real issue here. If you're going to be in a wheelchair for 100 years, you're not much good to anybody. Yeah. But if, in fact, you're going to be fit and healthy at 120 and still doing marathons, and at 150 you're going to start slowing down and thinking about retirement, that changes everything. In other words, we slow the aging process, so every year today is actually 2 years. It's a very different proposition to people surviving as old people for a very, very long time. Mm. I think that's one of the big uncertainties in this longevity issue, that we've already seen society unable to cope with extending life from 65 to 85 without changing all the social systems. So I've got some interesting views as to what kind of path or chaos or whatever we're going to look forward to if and when this happens.
I think it's going to be a longer period of active, healthy life. And I think that's already happened to a large extent. I mean, you look at the current people in their 70s now compared to people in their 70s 30 or 40 years ago, and it's a whole different story. There's a lot of people still working. There's a lot of people fit, active, extremely healthy. I mean, my parents-in-law are in their late 70s and they're still running around doing all sorts of things. And I think that's what we'll see. We'll see a kick out of that middle period of life where people are still active, healthy. And we'll actually need that, because if people are living this long, we're going to need them to keep working, because who's going to keep the place running? You can't have everyone retired for 100 years because there's not enough young people coming through to do all the jobs. So I really hope it's that, or we're in a bit of trouble.
Yeah. It's an interesting, on the UK Institute's website, they had an interview, they've taped an interview with a guy called Sir Harry Burns, who was one of the sessional meetings in the UK, and he's the head of the Scottish Health, whatever, I don't know, minister. He's not a minister, but he's certainly head of the health department. And he had an interesting discussion about the mortality rate of Scottish people compared to the other Europeans. And what they found was that Scottish people used to live longer on average than other Europeans. And whilst over the last 20 years mortality has improved, they now live the shortest of other European countries. And they had a big exercise to try and work out why it was that they've sort of lost their ranking. And there's a whole heap of stuff about cortisone in your blood and stress. And what it came down to was that people who feel like they've got a meaning in life, they've got some sort of purpose in life, they seem to have lower stress and they seem to live longer and more healthy lives. And there's this term called biopsychosocial, which was something I heard at the Accident Comp seminar, where what they're saying is that the countries that are going to win going forwards, the most productive countries, will be those that are able to manage the psychosocial issues of what's in the brains of their citizens more efficiently. So whilst you can fix all the health things up, unless you get that bit right as well, you've got a purpose for living, then that's what's going to hold back mortality. If you get that right, then that will be the best thing forward. Then people will want to work because they'll feel like they've got some value in the world.
Thanks. Romani?
Ramani from Promontory. It's very heartening to note that in the brave new world, actuaries will all shrivel to take the place of brains. I can nominate certain other professions to take other parts of the anatomy. it will be a very interesting exercise. But to be a bit more serious, if we have to make any sense of what the future would look like, I think we also need to look at, following our own technical training, what the past has looked like. One thing which intrigues me, even many of these professional forums, actuaries included, why there is very seldom any discussion on what is it that this profession did wrong in the lead up to GFC. Where did we fail? What did we get right? Where can we hang our heads in shame? Is it because we want to avoid the hard topic, or is it because we think that we have nothing to learn from it?
You can take that one, Barry.
Well, I didn't hold my head in shame as an actuary. I thought the actuarial profession came out quite well out of the GFC, actually. And there were plenty of actuaries that did see those sorts of things coming. And there was no life companies other than a major life company, but it was for a non-insurance activity that had a problem. So, I mean, I think that's a black swan event. Nobody saw. People should have seen coming. Nobody did see coming.
I'm also just going to rule it a little bit out of order because it's not really longevity related. So
no, but I'm on GFC. That's right. It's not longevity related, but it is a case of, with the longevity thing, we've told you it's coming, so don't say you haven't been told.
Yeah. And I'm interrupting because we're under time pressure, and I think we can probably sneak in one more question if there is anybody with another burning issue.
Jonathan Sheed here. Barry, you referred to each generation paying for itself, and Melinda, you also referred to not enough young people coming through, and a concept that intrigues me, and I'd be curious if you've given it any thought, is we save for retirement and we fund our retirement, but we're just setting aside capital that we're going to use to pay someone to do stuff? And how do you model what happens in a global economy for the next generation that in our retirement we are going to pay to do stuff for us? How do you capture that dynamic? I've seen some kind of non-actuarial literature on it, but I'm curious if you came across anything.
Oh, yeah, to you,
I haven't seen anything in my travels, but you'd be right to think that there'll be a massive services industry for in those generations, and that's where a lot of the jobs will be. Yeah, I haven't seen anything on that sort of social change, but yeah, it'd be interesting to have a look into.
And a lot of, because we haven't mentioned health, we haven't done health in our projections, that's actually where the people will be, isn't it, is in the health sector. What we're looking at is just building up assets for us to spend to keep us going on things other than health. So health is a whole new dimension, and one that you can see that it's going to explode in costs. I mean, the thing about living longer is that's sort of a linear increase in the cost of post-retirement income, but health could be a exponential increase in costs.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up there and say thank you very much from me personally as well for a very interesting, stimulating, thought-provoking paper and presentation. Please join with me in thanking Barry and Melinda in the usual way.